That is the secret of all culture. It does not provide artificial limbs, wax noses, or spectacles. That which can provide these things is rather only sham education. Culture is liberation, the removal of all the weeds, rubble, and vermin that want to attack the tender buds of the plant. Friedrich Nietzsche. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week, and I just want to go ahead and say I appreciate everyone's support. We have surpassed 500 downloads again this month. That's back-to-back months with over 500. I'm hoping maybe we'll keep up, maybe on pace with last month. Maybe we'll tie it, or maybe get a little bit more. Of course, there's only 1 week left, so maybe not, but regardless, still hugely thankful for all the returning listeners, new listeners. Thank you all so much. And if you are a new listener, please go and avail yourself of our backlog of episodes. So, and I was very pleased at how well received the last episode was. I think it's one of the better ones I've done. So, this week we're going to be talking about a number of material cultures popping up along the Nile Valley. Before that, though, I did have a question about the term Middle Egypt and Middle Nubia. Because I just mentioned Upper Egypt, Lower Egypt, Upper Nubia, Lower Nubia. These are modern terms, and the Egyptians did not use them. And, of course, they're convenient for us for helping people visualize kind of where along the Nile a place may be. They exist outside of the upper and lower designation of Egypt and Nubia, respectively. It's just, obviously, upper and lower, whether you have that orientated, you know, what we might consider correctly or not, based on elevation, middle is middle, regardless, doesn't matter which way you're coming from. So I'm going to probably use those terms later. But it's not a designation that the Egyptians would have used. It's something that only modern academics have developed and are using. Now, with that out of the way, I want to go ahead and spend this week, again, talking about a number of material cultures developing, again, all along the Nile. And some may have been mentioned last season, while others are now just making a significant impact on the archaeological record. And to start, we need to talk about the culture known as the Fayum A culture. And I talked about them last season. These are the people typically associated with the spread of crops, animals, the domesticates, and things like that associated with them. And this is kind of south and west from the lower or northern Egyptian Nile Delta region. Most of what has been found of this culture, or at least the earliest evidence of this culture, has been found around the Fayum Depression, that is kind of to the west of the Nile before it begins to spread out into the Nile Delta. In the past, there was a larger channel or small branch of the Nile that basically fed a large freshwater lake. The Egyptians called it Payam, or something similar to that. And that meant literally lake or sea, which evolved into the Coptic Fayum. And this is what was adapted into Arabic as Fayum. Now, it's possible that this culture was actually primarily centered in the Nile Delta, but because of the marshy, wetter environment there, it's hard to find archaeological evidence of what was happening there. Though there has been some small bits of evidence showing at least, you know, a material connection between the Delta and Fayum. And also, this marshy terrain in the Delta is going to make even excavation during chronicling like historical periods more difficult as well. The Fayum the environment there does not lend itself to preserving a lot of material aside from stone. And even then, it can be destructive to stone as well. But again, let's just go ahead and focus on the Fayum. I'm going to kind of recap a little bit of what we talked about last season, but this culture appears to have emerged from a collection of peoples living in and around the Fayum, possibly the Delta as well. And then, since at least 9,000 BC, time progressed to the start date of this season. And during this period, this culture, or at least various aspects associated with the culture, develop over time in the Fayum, and then they spread out from there until around you get to the start of this season, or maybe give or take a century or two later than that, you begin to see a number of small Neolithic towns and villages start to appear up and down the Nile. Now, how closely related all these sites are to each other is debated, and it, as is the ethnic and geographic origin of said peoples and of said culture and sites. Like we talked about last week, no one knows for sure about this, and the evidence we have is debated, and different pieces of said evidence is given different weight depending on which theory the presenter prefers. And again, I'm one of the people that think it doesn't really matter too much in the grand scheme of things because, well, Egyptian culture is going to become Egyptian culture regardless of, you know, how, what percentage of the people may have come to the come from the Levant 2,000 years before this period, or if they stayed in Egypt and just imported the goods from the Middle East, you know, just traded the goods and didn't have any people. It doesn't really matter when incoming and outcoming groups arrive in this pre-historical period. Because by the time you get to the historical period, Egypt, Egyptian culture, or cultures of Egypt, I should say, have at that point become firmly established. And it becomes kind of this monolithic thing that kind of takes over anything that kind of comes in contact with to one extent or another. But again, that's all in the future. So again, regardless of the exact point of origin or whether or not they are descended from settlers, breakaway groups, or just groups influenced by the Fayum A culture, after 6,000 BC or so, several of these small villages and groups begin to innovate and develop new and different styles, traditions, whatever you want to call it. And some of these are wider spread than others, with some only being found at one specific site, while others are spread across a few kilometers of the Nile's banks before giving way to another regional material culture or an area under the sway of several of these cultures. There might be some places that are in contact with a couple of these larger, more organized or developed cultures. And we're going to start with the ones in Upper Egypt and then move north. Though there are a couple of points I will say about the Fayum. First, the art of weaving was first practiced in Egypt in the Fayum. At least from what we can tell, there's nothing earlier. And they would be making linen from flax, which had spread from the Middle East. Which, again, flax I think is potentially coming from the Caucasus initially. So it's been making its way for about 5,000 years to get to the Egyptians. 4,000 or 5,000 years, give or take. Other artifacts made in the Fayum A style will continue till around 5,300, 5,100 BC, BCE. So it's got about, again, we're not quite sure exactly when the full Fayum toolkit culture emerges. It could have been around 6,000 BC. It could have been, you know, a couple of hundred years before that. So maybe around 1,000 years of kind of the Fayum cultural dominance, or at least more Fayum artifacts are identifiable than anything else for around 1,000 years. And the reason that this begins to change, the region that this culture apparently disappears, is not due to climate change, invasion, etc. At least not that we can tell. But at that point in time, pottery begins to become much more ubiquitous in the Nile Valley regions. With the peoples on the edges of the Fayum's cultural territory encountering more and more pottery being imported from Asia and or possibly from groups to the southeast from migrants escaping the drying Sahara. But these fringe areas kind of begin to experiment and develop their own expressions of this technology and others, which, again, led to unique expressions in other mediums and expressions which begin to become more prominent in their home territories and then on their bordering territories. And again, the Fayum kind of being off of the Nile, it's kind of to the north westish of the Nile. It's not kind of a direct route. You have to want to travel directly into the Fayum, whereas the Nile, you can just go up and down it. It's a more direct route from all these different places. Now, I should say, though, that some tools kind of remain unchanged, though, at least for a long period of time, even after other Fayum cultural materials disappear or become less widespread. The tool types are generally more or less unique, with the exception, of course, of new tools being invented, which... A lot of the basic kind of Neolithic toolkits that the Fayum provides, they remain in use even after other cultures become dominant, at least for other types of goods and things like that. And that leads me into, again, one of these newer cultures that's emerging as this process takes place. And there are around three that emerge at this point in time. And we're going to start in the south, moving up from the area that we covered last episode. The first of these cultures to emerge is the Badarian culture. It gets its name from the town where the remains of this culture was first found. That's El Badari. And this culture was concentrated along a 19-mile, which is around a 30-kilometer stretch along the eastern bank of the Nile. Though they did have contacts outside of this stretch, and not just along the Nile, but also into the desert reaches to the east toward the Red Sea. And this one leads me kind of to bring up another topic. And I spoke last week about one of the Egyptian terms for the fertile land and how it was referred to as Kemet or Hemet, or the dark or black land. For the desert regions to the east and west of the river banks, they used the term Desheret or Deshret or Dasrat, and this meant the red land. And this, again, refers to both the eastern and western deserts on both sides of the Nile. But the specific stretch that the Badari culture goes along is called the Wadi Hammamat. And this is an Arabic term, and it translates to something like Valley of Many Baths. And I couldn't confirm if this was a direct translation from an ancient Egyptian term, but the Coptic term was something I couldn't really get a solid pronunciation on. And I used a site specializing in translating Coptic, and it has a translation as to draw in or draw them in. Though Wikipedia says the romanization of the Egyptian was Rohinto or Ronto. Now, this supposedly literally translates to India Way or Gateway to India. I'm a little dubious of that, at least partly because it's Wikipedia. I try to not get most of my sources from Wikipedia, but occasionally you have to work with what you got. But obviously, trade with India does get established. This is actually one of the big terminus points of the Silk Road, at least sea trade-wise. But that doesn't happen until much later. So what the Egyptians called the Wadi Hammamat before then, it may have been literally the Valley of Many Baths. But essentially what this is, it's a dried-up lake bed from when the region obviously had regular flow from the Nile into the Red Sea. And there are still oases between the Nile and to areas along the Red Sea. And this is going to be a very important region once you get to the dynastic period. There are quarries all throughout this area where a ton of different stones and other material are found and quarried and imported back into the Nile or carried to settlements along the Red Sea coast, where it will eventually be loaded onto ships and then sailed down to Punt or Arabia, or if Punt possibly is in Arabia. And of course, from there, they would of course bring stuff back and then through the Wadi Hammamat. The Wadi Hammamat is also a good source of natron, which is an important preservative for Egyptian mummies at later dates. The Badarian culture is obviously, at the very least, obtaining stone from this region. And it's probably something that really helps them develop. And the Badarian culture is very kind of developed in terms of the types of things that they're working with. They are not just hunter-gatherers. They are not just agriculturalists. They're not just fishers. They're not just pastoralists. They have all of these things that they are using to contribute to and build kind of a life for themselves. And it's possible that they have been working and doing this since at least 5000 BC, though some sources kind of have this at a later period. I think it's likely that they began to form at 5000 or so BC, and then they really hit their high point right around 4300, 4200 BC, and then from there they kind of begin to get supplanted by other cultures, or they begin to merge with another culture that we'll talk about a little bit later. In addition, like I said, they were prolific in terms of their modes of living. They are fishers. They are hunters. They are very good at kind of hunting waterfowl. They use boomerangs to hunt. And boomerangs are great for like throwing into flocks of birds. They keep sheep, goats, possibly cattle. They did keep cattle. There was a different group that's not as, they're not as sure on. But they also hunted wild gazelle that would come into kind of their region of the Nile. They also had dogs. But when it comes to agriculture, they're the first people that we can definitively say were practicing true 100% planned out grid based planned like inundation agriculture. Other groups probably practiced it earlier, but we only have kind of secondary evidence. Like we have things that might be associated with that, but it's not definitive. But in this case, we definitely have evidence that yes, the Badarians were absolutely practicing centralized planned agriculture. Though how that was organized, we obviously have no idea. Was it at a community level where a couple of different villages were all kind of working together and planning together, or was it kind of a singular authority figure that was making this decision? We do have at least some evidence, maybe circumstantial, that they did have some type of social stratification. There are a number of different cemeteries that we found, and there is evidence that some people are buried with much more material wealth than others. And that includes different types of decoration, ornaments, pottery. The Badarians seem to have just had a typical type of pottery style. They had different shapes for their vessels, but they all seem to be decorated in a very similar way, with kind of a red or brown bottom half, and then the top is kind of a dark black kind of color. And they're actually very, very interesting looking. They're not very intricate. They don't, as far as I could see, I didn't see any examples that had these really intricate designs. It is just their coloration that is kind of stand out. There's also evidence that they had trade with other regions, and not just to the Wadi Hamimat, but they had turquoise from Sinai, which is, well, probably from the Sinai. That's the only kind of location that's nearby that would have had turquoise. Though, if they got turquoise directly from the Sinai, that's not as well established and kind of debated. It's possible that they got turquoise through trade with the Delta region, which, you know, seems probably the more stable route, getting, because at this early stage, while they do have some boats, they're not very large, and going deep into the sea, crossing the Red Sea, probably not the easiest thing in the world. Their boats are definitely more for just sailing up and down the Nile. They had shells from the Red Sea, so they did have access to the sea itself, but crossing the sea, getting stuff, and crossing the sea again, probably not as likely. But yes, they have shell necklaces. They have different semi-precious stones that they would decorate their tools with. I think one of the big ones that they have found is malachite, which is kind of a greenish ore. Most of their tools are flint. In fact, I think almost all of their tools are flint. Though, they do have some ivory, quartz, and copper materials. Though, again, this is kind of the earliest stages of copper, so it's not really being fashioned as tools. It's more being cold rolled and things like that, just kind of roughly hammered, at least this season. I think later seasons, or start of next season, it's possible that they could have developed some basic level of metallurgy, though that is possible. It's a later group that we'll be talking about. Their dead are all wrapped in reeds and other things. And they're all, interestingly enough, typically buried facing the west. And this is kind of like a really big common thing in later Egyptian history. And we'll talk about that when we get to Egyptian religion and mythology. But the west, or in this case the western bank of the Nile, is the land of the dead. Not necessarily in a literal sense, but in a literal sense and a figurative sense. When you go to the west, that's kind of a euphemism for someone dying. And we'll talk more about that in the future. We don't have examples of their houses. They may have had some wood in their houses, which there are trees growing along the Nile, but they're not very large. Most likely, they were reed and kind of simple wood or possibly mud huts. Don't believe they had mud brick. Don't think they were using stone for that just yet. But that's not unusual. Mud brick is something that doesn't really become more widespread, at least in Egypt, until later periods. So, but yeah, so that's kind of the highlights of the Badarian culture. And again, they do have at least what appear to be solid contacts with groups both to the north and to the south. They did have carvings of different animals, including hippos, gazelles, things like that. And there are, of course, in later periods, hippopotamus gods and along those things like that. So it's possible that these are just early examples of the Egyptian religion as it is beginning to assume a form that we are more familiar with. They also had depictions of humans. There's like a very prominent picture. I think you can find it. It's like one of the big pictures on Wikipedia for this culture, which again, I don't typically like using Wikipedia, but the pictures are of actual Badarian artifacts. It is a woman. She is nude. She has carving around the pubic region that is shaped like a triangle. Her eyes are very open and wide. She's got these very large eyebrows, and her hair appears to be long and kind of wavy. And her arms are kind of crossed underneath her bosom, which isn't a pose that I'm familiar with in later Egyptian art. Egyptian art doesn't really change a lot, but that's not a pose that I typically associate with Egyptian art. So what that woman's meant to represent, I don't know. And I don't think there's any real solid theory about what this is. But now it's time to move along to our next culture. Or maybe not. This is where we hit a little bit of a snag and a debate. The second culture we're going to talk about is known as the Tassian culture. And it, like the Badari, is located along the eastern bank. It goes further north. It is today found around Deir Tassa, which I believe is the location that it was first found. And there is, again, quite a bit of debate about, is this its own culture, or is this maybe an offshoot of the Badari culture? And we're going to talk about some of the similarities and potential things that are different about them. These kind of earlier locations, they also had a range along the eastern bank of the Nile. Again, they occupied the eastern bank, and they were occupying a range of about 55 miles, which is 89 kilometers-ish. So they had a much longer range than the Badari culture did, if, again, they are different cultures. The issue kind of arises in the timing. As I said, some theorize the Badari started as early as 5000 BC, whereas the Tassian is generally considered, again, for those that consider it a separate culture, to for sure have begun by about 4500 BC. But again, the Badari don't really hit their stride until a little bit later. And the thing is, their range, at least their proposed ranges, do overlap to an extent. Though, again, there are some slight differences in some of their material cultures. I think the Tassian culture is not quite as heavily associated with agriculture. But their pottery is very similar. The Tassian culture also has blacktop pottery, though I think they have a little bit more intricate designs. They will do like patterns and things like that, at least from what I've seen. Like the British Museum has a picture of a kind of a beaker, and that has a lot of designs, whereas the Badarian stuff, there are no lines. It's all just kind of smooth, painted red and black pottery. So it's possible that these were two separate groups, but because of their kind of proximity to each other, they began to kind of merge and exchange artifacts with each other. Of course, to these people, it wouldn't be artifacts. It'd be useful material. And the Tassian could have been one of the trade links to groups in the north with the Badari. I'm of the opinion they're probably the same culture. But I think maybe once agriculture began to become a more vital part of their lifestyle, they maybe consolidated their range to what we might consider the Badari kind of homeland, for lack of a better word. Just because it would have been easier to maintain dikes and fields and that kind of thing. Though, of course, I doubt what would that northern portion of what might have been Tassians would have just been completely abandoned. It just probably wouldn't have been as closely as associated. It probably would have been something a little bit different. So I do think the Tassian culture does do something a little bit different with their burials. They also use straw kind of wrappings or coffins. But the bodies of the Tassian culture are usually in kind of this bent position, or crouching position is sometimes called. There's a theory that a lot of cultures that kind of like have their dead kind of balled up like that, it's kind of like they're putting them into like the fetal position so that they'll be born into their next life, much like a newborn would be coming into the world. But again, that's debated. But the Tassian culture kind of ends right around 4000 BC, give or take, if, again, it is a separate culture. But that leads us into the next culture to talk about this week. And this one is, again, further north in Lower Egypt, close to the Nile Delta, actually. And, of course, when I say close, I mean it is actually in the Nile Delta, or at least the primary site associated with this culture is located in the Nile Delta. In fact, it's about 28 miles kind of to the north westish of modern-day Cairo, and that's about 45 kilometers, I believe, give or take. And this is the Merimdi culture, or sometimes you'll see it called the Beni Salam culture. And this is a little bit shorter lived than the other two that we've talked about. It's kind of estimated to have emerged right around, well, during the period between 4800 and 4300 BCE. Although, of course, the site was probably occupied before that and definitely after that. It's just that this culture kind of really emerges as a separate identity at this time. And, of course, after this period, it begins to lose some of its individuality. It begins to look like something different altogether. From what we can tell, these people were practicing agriculture. They did fish and hunt, but it was not quite as widespread as, say, the Tassian and Badarian examples of this. That it seems like most of their food does come from agriculture. And it's from what I didn't see any reference to any kind of pastoralism. That might be due to the environment. The wetlands may not have been the best place to have large amounts of herds. I think, obviously, the water would have been nice, but kind of the grassland needed to graze may not have been the best. But again, that could just be me missing it mentioned in the sources, which is certainly very possible. Their houses are, again, small huts made of reed and wattle, and most of them are rounded, though there are some that are kind of more oblong or oval shaped. And they had pottery, but it was very bare bones. There were no real designs on it, and it didn't have like a distinctive paint or coloring the way that the Tassian and the Badarian did. Also, very different in terms of burial practices. They did not have separate cemeteries the way those cultures did, or later Egyptians would. And in fact, they appear to be buried underneath the settlements that they lived in life. This is something that you see in other places. We've talked about several places, both in Western and Eastern Asia, about the dead being buried like underneath their families' homes specifically. Also, they did not seem to bury them with grave goods. So maybe not any kind of social stratification. That is a possibility. Their sickles were very straightforward, and they were not really sickles at all. They were more just kind of like elongated knives with kind of two different faces, essentially. They're bifacial. And they would just be kind of inserted into wood. Probably not the easiest thing to use to in terms of sickle, and but it will be something that lasts for a while. They don't develop better sickles until much later. So most of the burials also are female in the grave sites that they have found. Also, they tend to be taller than what you'll see in later Egyptian burials. That could be because they've just begun to switch to an agricultural-based diet. And that is something you see in a lot of early agricultural peoples. After a generation or two, they start to shorten down just because they're missing out on a lot of the nutrition. They haven't fully adapted to the diet and minerals and vitamins that the plants are growing or providing. Of course, again, they'll begin to get taller again later, but that's usually something that happens a lot later, especially if they don't have like regular sources of meat or vitamin D or things like that. So, now, these people, I said they last about 4,300. That's kind of their high watermark. But after that, they begin again to lose kind of their uniqueness, and they're probably adapting to other cultures that are kind of beginning to emerge at that point in time. And they're, of course, developing cities, although, again, Egypt, a little bit smaller cities, more closer to villages and towns than true cities, at least at the earliest stages. That eventually that's going to change. Again, the Delta is never really that popular in terms of large population centers for the Egyptians. There are some reasons for this, and we'll get into it. You'll find that most of the major Egyptian settlements and cities of power are more along the Nile itself and not so much in the Delta. But again, that's all stuff that we're going to talk about in the future. As this season's ending, one final real culture is going to emerge. And it's going to be one of our big focus points next season for Egypt. But it does begin to arise this season. And that is known as the Nakata culture. Now, this culture is divided into multiple phases. I'm not going to go into too much detail now, but it is one of the phases of the Nakata culture is going to give rise to the proto-dynastic period, or the pre-dynastic period of Egypt, which technically we're in the pre-dynastic period now. By the time that this part of the Nakata culture ends next season, we're going to be in the time of the pharaohs. And a lot of iconography and things associated with the earlier dynastic portions of Egyptian history are already fully established in art, inscriptions, all this kind of stuff. And these scenes and depictions and motifs, they're going to remain almost constant through Egyptian history, with some innovations and evolutions, but the basis is there by next season. So while we don't have much in the terms of artistic representation for this season, definitely things that are going to show up within the next 1,000 years after the end of this season are definitely being talked about, are definitely being discussed, at the very least at some level. And we're going to go into some of that in our next episode. I want to talk about Egyptian mythology, and I want to go over some of their big ideas about the creation of the world, history, and the establishment of their social order. So that's going to be what we're going to talk about next week, and maybe the week after. It'll depend on how long I want to do it. I had initially planned on taking a couple of weeks off, but I think it's just might just be the one. I might just do it without the break for the 4th. I don't know yet. I'm kind of trying to decide. I'll definitely let you know next week, but there is going to be an episode next week. Might be a little bit of a shorter one, but there will be one. So I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I hope I didn't ramble too much. I hope I was clear. But if you have any questions or feedback or constructive criticism, please let me know. You can email me at war@revpod@gmail.com. You can direct message me on X/Twitter. You are welcome to comment on any of my YouTube videos. I do respond to those. It may take me a little bit. Also I live stream on YouTube during the week. You're welcome to drop in, say hi, ask questions there. However you'd like to give feedback, I'd be happy to receive it. So thank you all so much. I really do appreciate all your support. I'm hoping the show is going to continue to do well and grow. Maybe we'll see even more growth over the next couple of weeks and months. So here's hoping. I'm already super pleased with how we're doing. Back-to-back over 500 downloads in 2 back-to-back months. Hopefully we can get back-to-back 1,000, because we did technically, I think, beat 1,000 last month across all platforms. But even retaining half of those new numbers, more than half of those new numbers, is fantastic. So I am not complaining at all. Thank you all again. I appreciate it, and please let me know if you have anything that you would like to discuss. Thank you all. I hope you have a good rest of your week and a good rest of your day whenever you're listening to this. Thank you all. Have a good evening and a good day. Goodbye.